With that, let's go ahead and begin the commission meeting. This is Tuesday, June 26th, 2007. It's approximately 10 o'clock in the morning. We're actually here at the University Center in Sioux Falls, room 282. We do have a number of commission staff and others located in Pierre at the state capitol. Our first item of the I'm Commissioner Dusty Johnson. Commissioners Gary Hansen and Steve Colbeck are also present here in Sioux Falls. With that, we'll begin item number one, which is under administration, approval of the minutes of the commission meeting held both on March 13th, 2007 and March 27th, 2007. The minutes have been reviewed independently by the commissioners. Are there any changes or suggestions, potential edits? Hearing none, does anyone have a motion? Motion's been made. No second is required. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Second item on the agenda is consumer reports, and that is a status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints which have been received by this commission. At this time, we'll look to Ms. Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The commission has received a total of 117 contacts since the last report was prepared for the June 5th, 2007 commission meeting. 21 of the contacts involved telecommunication services. 34 of the contacts involved electrical services. 9 contacts involved natural gas services. 13 contacts involved cellular phone service. 25 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 15 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC, and 1,073 of the 1,236 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved, and 2,257 of the 2,466 complaints received in 2006 have been resolved.
Great. Thanks, Ms. Gregg. How are we coming through as far as volume on your end?
We can hear you. It's really
okay.
Clear.
Great. Thanks very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Gregg? Right. Hearing none, we'll actually proceed. We're going to shuffle around our agenda a little bit. At first, I'll look to Ms. Strauss or Ms. Wojnar. You know, I don't know that we've got all everybody on from Relay. Would you like us to defer action on these items, on the Hawk Relay items, or would you like us to proceed?
I think this is Karen Strauss, Mr. Chairman. I believe that the people that you're waiting for may be from the FCC.
Okay.
I believe, I mean, we are here for CSDVRS, so we are not waiting for anybody on Relay.
Okay.
And Mr. Hawk is comfortable going ahead with the meeting as well.
And it's okay going forward without anyone from the FCC on the line?
Yes. Mr. Hawk is responding.
Great. Thanks. Well, with that, let's go ahead and move to... Okay, thanks very much. With that, let's move to the telecommunications portion of the docket. Item number one is TC07-014, and that does deal with the application of Hawk Relay, LLC, for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunications services in South Dakota. And the question before this commission today is, shall it grant a certificate of authority to Hawk Relay, LLC, as the moving party? We will first look to Hawk Relay and see if they have anything to say with regard to their application. Anyone from Hawk Relay on the line wishing to make any comments?
Yes, this is Christian Warner, and I wanted to offer some information about VRS services for the deaf. Do you have the authority to go ahead with the certificate? I've taken a look at it and think that things should go forward. I've gone through the application process.
Okay, thank you very much. At this time, we would look towards staff, Mr. Rounds, Mr. Sanger, or Ms. Kramer for their comments.
Yes, this is Keith Sanger from Commission Staff. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine, Keith.
On February 23, 2007, Hawk Relay submitted an application for an interexchange certificate of authority in accordance with ARSD 2010-2402. Specifically, Hawk Relay is a video relay, or VRS, an Internet Protocol Relay, or IP relay, provider, and is seeking certification so it can be eligible for reimbursement as an interstate telecommunication relay, TRS fund, reimbursement as a video, a VRS or IP relay provider. In March of 2000, the FCC recognized VRS as a form of TRS. VRS allows the user to communicate in sign language via a broadband video link instead of a text-based VRS, instead of a text-based TRS, which has limitations. In April of 2002, the FCC recognized IP relay as another form of TRS. IP relay allows the user to place text calls from any internet-connected computer rather than dedicated TTY. Unlike TRS services, VRS and IP relay uses the internet for at least one leg of the call. Thus, it is not currently possible to determine the origination or the termination of the internet side of the call, therefore making it impossible to determine whether the call is a local or interstate or intrastate. As a result, the FCC has ruled on an interim basis that the VRS and IP relay calls are interstate in nature, and the cost of providing both interstate and intrastate VRS and IP relay are compensated from the interstate TRS fund. Therefore, the FCC ruled that common carriers seeking to provide VRS or IP relay and only those services should not be precluded from doing so simply because they cannot contract with a state or other eligible TRS provider, and thus creating new eligibility categories for federal certification of VRS and IP relay providers. With this step, the FCC has opened the door for VRS and IP relay providers like Hawk Relay to provide those services and to get compensated directly from the interstate TRS fund. One of the criteria for FCC certification for interstate TRS fund eligibility is demonstration of status as a common carrier. This causes some concern. First of all, I find it somewhat odd that a state commission has to certify common carrier status for interstate compensated services such as VRS and IP relay. Second, I'm not sure that the services provided qualify as telecommunication services that justify common carrier status designation. The FCC has clearly indicated in paragraph 22 of its December 12, 2005 order that demonstration of status as a common carrier is necessary to be eligible for the TRS fund compensation. Additionally, in footnote 84 of that same order, the FCC indicated that non-common carriers seeking to offer VRS or IP relay may continue to do so by joining a certified state program or subcontracting with an entity offering TRS and eligible for compensation from that fund. So the FCC has distinguished between common carriers and non-common carriers for TRS services. Hawk Relay has indicated that they want to get out from subcontracting and wish to seek direct compensation from the interstate TRS fund. In fact, the reason for this application is to get a COA from the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission in order to demonstrate common carrier status. However, Hawk Relay will not be providing any of the traditional telecom services that this commission usually issues a COA for. The question in my mind is, does VRS or IP relay qualify an entity as a common carrier? If it does, then why does the FCC make Hawk Relay jump through this loop? Based on footnote 84, as I referred to earlier, I tend to think that providing only TRS services does not qualify as a common carrier status. If this service does not qualify as a common, as a telecommunications service, should this commission give Hawk Relay a COA since it will not be providing traditional telecommunications services of a common carrier? I can find no FCC or state guidance on this matter, but I found other state commissions who have issued COAs to like entities. In the end, with the exception of a few requested waivers, Hawk Relay has provided all of the required information and thus has met the commission criteria for a certificate of authority, and thus it is as deserving as any other company in receiving a COA. Keep in mind that we have issued other COAs for other carriers who never really ever intend to provide any telecommunication services to any South Dakota customers. Why should Hawk Relay be any different? Therefore, in the end, I recommend that the Commission grant Hawk Relay an inter-exchange certificate of authority and grant a waiver from providing financial statements and a waiver from providing the tariff, since they are not providing any of the traditional tariff services that require end-user billings. Additionally, I recommend, and Hawk Relay has agreed, that the COA contain the standard restrictions from providing any prepaid services and from accepting or collecting any deposits or advance payments. I also recommend, and Hawk Relay has agreed, to the restriction from providing any end-user services that require end-user billings, and thus removing the need for that tariff. I also believe that this order should limit Hawk Relay's COA to the provision of VRS services, IP relay, or any other future FCC-approved TRS services. If Hawk Relay should ever wish to provide any end-user billing services or prepaid services or collect advance payments or deposits from any customer, Hawk Relay would need to seek additional commission authority. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. We appreciate that, in particular the fact that you, I mean, this is not a typical COA for us, so I certainly appreciate you getting us from A to Z, walking us through this process and why this docket is before us. At this time, we will pause to see if there are any commissioner or advisor questions or comments. Yeah, Mr. Smith, go ahead.
Excuse me, Keith. This is John Smith. I can't find it in the FCC order right now, but I recall when I read this the first time, language in there that seemed to indicate that the FCC did not require that any of these services actually provide ordinary telecommunications services to be considered common carriers. You know, they used language like form over substance and that kind of thing, and seemed to recognize them if they're generally offering their services as available to the public, as opposed to a particular contract situation, that they seem to recognize them as common carriers, regardless of whether they were providing what we would call traditional telecommunications services. And did I read the order correctly, or did I miss something in there?
John, this is Keith. I've read the order several times, and I seem to think that the FCC kind of ducked. There's no doubt in my mind in reading the order that the FCC wanted to provide an avenue for carriers such as Hawk Relay to recover to seek reimbursement directly from the federal TRS fund. But one of the standards that they have in there, because after this process, Hawk Relay is going to have to go to the FCC to get approval. And the reason why Hawk is here is to determine or to get common carrier status. They're going to need a COA from us. because that is one of the eligibility requirements of the FCC. It states it in paragraph, I got to pull the order. I think it's 23 of the order. Let me pull it quick here. I don't see, I think it's page 20, or paragraph, I'm not finding it right now, but I'm pretty sure number 7, if I remember correctly, of one of the criteria. And then it goes on to state that if you're not a common carrier, you have to subcontract. You can't get paid directly. So they're clearly indicating common carrier, non-common carrier. So to me, that's saying that the FCC is not viewing those people those entities who are only providing VRS or IP relay as common carriers. So it puts me in kind of a situation where, you know, the FCC is, they want these people, but they got to be a common carrier, or they want these entities, but they have to be a common carrier. And so I didn't necessarily read it the way you did.
Keith, maybe take a look at paragraph 26, which happens to be a paragraph that you circled for me. So it helped me find it finally. The only thing I'm looking at is... And again, I think you're right. It's sort of an attempt by the FCC to pigeonhole this into a category where practicality can win out. But it basically as I read it, says without regard to the provision of traditional PSTN-based telephony. And I guess that inconsistency is I don't get it, and I guess the other anomaly here is that the FCC certification program seems to be offered as an alternative to state certification. So I'm just curious. I guess it's more of a question, just out of curiosity. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just wondering. I'm kind of wondering what this is all about when this is an FCC certification process.
Yeah, and I understand that, and I read that now. And to me, it just totally baffles me because you don't have to be providing traditional telecommunication services, but yet they go through that whole rigmarole of being a common carrier. And they say, you know, because of footnote 84, it indicates that, well, if you're not a common carrier providing these services, the VRS or the IP relay. So to me, that's a hint that just because you're providing VRS and IP relay, you're not necessarily a common carrier. But above all that, getting away from all of that, I don't believe that we're actually saying, hey, this company's a common carrier, because if we have a brand new company who comes in and who has never provided any telecommunication services before, all we're doing is say, yes, we're giving you the authority to go ahead and do that. So that's kind of the way I look at it. We're doing that with Hawk Relay here. And, you know, giving them certificate of authority. And if the FCC wants to say that, yeah, that is determined as common carrier status, then fine, I'm good with that.
And
sorry to interrupt, Mr. Smith. Dusty Johnson here. You know, I understand this doesn't fit into our normal standard COA box, but and let me know if I'm missing something, but I certainly don't see any harm by approving the COA, even if it is very unconventional.
Well, I agree, and I believe what the FCC was getting at with common carrier might not, because they say you don't have to be an ordinary. It says it in black and white right in front of my face. I think what they're getting at is the services have to be offered on a non-discriminatory basis generally to the public. That's my own opinion, you know. But
And Hawk Relay has indicated that they're offering it to anyone and everyone who has access to their website. I mean, their website is a very easy website. They advertise it as such. So, you know, and clearly I agree with you, Commissioner Johnson, that I see no harm, and that's why I recommended approval. It's just that it's a very cumbersome method to go through this, and I find it, you know, the way the FCC has done this, I don't know, it's
Well, Mr. Singer, look at it this way. As soon as we start to think that COAs are a routine and ministerial matter, you get an interesting one. So any other commissioner or advisor comments or questions? Yes, Commissioner Kolbeck.
Yes, this is Commissioner Kolbeck. This is for Mr. Hawk. I believe you mentioned a website. Is that up and running and currently performing at 100%, or is there more to do?
Yes, the website is running, and we have been offering services since October of this last year. But we have been working as a subcontractor under another organization who already has certification of authority. So we're just trying to branch out onto our own and receive our own certification instead of subcontracting through another organization.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Hearing none, motion would be in order, and I would move that the commission grant a certificate of authority to Hawk Relay LLC with the waivers and standard restrictions that were recommended by staff. Motion has been made. No second is required. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you very much. With that, we'll jump around just a little bit and move to agenda item number 5 under telecommunications, which is the matter of the application of CSDVRS LLC for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunications services in South Dakota. And the question before the commission today is, shall it grant a certificate of authority to CSDVRS LLC? And perhaps before moving to the applicant, we will look to staff, Mr. Singer, Ms. Kramer, for any introductory comments you've got.
This is Keith Singer again. This essentially is exactly the same. The only difference that I was able to determine is that CSDVRS is only going to be providing VRS services. They will not be providing the IP relay. With that, I would just recommend that the commission grant CSDVRS and IXC certificate of authority and grant them the waiver from providing the tariff, since they are not providing traditional tariff services that require end user billings. And I recommend that the COA contain the standard restrictions from advanced payments, customer deposits, and prepaids, and that it also contain a restriction from any end user from providing any end user services that require end user billings, and that the order should contain that they were providing VRS and IP or
Bill
other
McClellan
is joining the meeting
or other future FCC TRS services. Essentially the same as the last.
Thanks very much, Mr. Singer. At this time, we will look to anyone from CSDVRS LLC for any comments they have on this proceeding.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. My name is Sarah Greff, and I'm an attorney representing CSDVRS. Staff speaks for itself, and we would request approval of our application. We do have on the line Karen Peltz-Strauss and Sean Belanger, as well as Randy Gerloff here in person, if you guys have any questions of us.
Great. Thanks very much, Ms. Greff. Any commissioner or advisor comments or questions? Certainly good to have Ms. Greff back in the commission room.
It's good to be back.
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Schnapp.
Ms. Greff, I noted Keith's condition about no end-user billings. Is that acceptable? Is that the way the business model works here?
It is. We get all of our funding through the TRS.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Hearing none, does anyone have any action?
Vote for approval on item TC07-073 with the waivers and stipulations as recommended by staff.
Motion's been made. No second is required. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
And Johnson votes aye, 3-0. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You know, I actually made an error earlier in the meeting. We heard from Ms. Gregg on the the consumer complaints. Ms. Gregg, are you still there?
Yes. I'm
still Ms. Gregg recently celebrated her 20th anniversary of service with state government, and I think everybody would agree that it is tough to find people who are more passionate about their work, more dedicated to doing a good job than Deb Gregg. And so we'd certainly like to take this opportunity to thank you for your service to the commission and award you a 20-year pin from the state of South Dakota.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. Thank you.
Any comments, Deb?
None. Thank you very much.
She's been admiring that pin.
No. What's that, Heather?
She's busy admiring her pin.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Well, Deb, you'll always be on our good side as long as you just stick around. And if you ever go anywhere, we won't frequent that business or agency of state government. So we will isolate them. Next item for action with this commission is actually the last item on our regular agenda under the administration. Item number one, and that's the establishment of a gross receipts tax levy for the 2008 fiscal year. The question is, today shall the commission establish the rate and assess the gross receipts tax as authorized in SDCL 49-1A-3? We will look to Ms. Gregg for her comments. Thanks.
Actually, it's
going to
be Ms.
Horn.
Thank you, Chairman.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I said actually it's going to be Ms. Horn instead of Ms. Gregg.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right. Sorry, misspoke. Go ahead, Ms. Forney.
Thank you. SDCL Chapter 49-1A establishes the Public Utilities Commission Gross Receipts Tax Fund. It's funded every year by an assessment based on the annual gross intrastate receipts received by public utilities. The fund is used by the commission to defray any regulatory expenses related to the regulation of telecommunications, electricity, and natural gas. On April 1st of each year, all utilities and telecommunications companies doing business in South Dakota are required to file with the commission the amount of their gross receipts derived from customers within South Dakota in the preceding calendar year. Based on those receipts, the commission is required to establish the rate and assess the tax authorized by SDCL 49-183, which, together with any funds remaining from the current fiscal year and the $250 minimum gross receipts tax, will fund our budget for the next fiscal year and provide a contingency reserve in an amount not to exceed the prior year's budget. In accordance with these standards set forth in SDCL 49-1A-4, I would recommend assessing the maximum rate of 0.0015 with a $250 minimum.
Thanks, Ms. Forney. Appreciate it. Maybe we'll just see, you know, maybe we'll just see this tax affects any ratepayer and any utility that's subject to it under state law. So maybe we'll just pause to see if anybody has any comments or questions about this.
This is Bob Miller from the investor-owned electric utilities. You're a bargain.
You will be quoted, Mr. Miller. Very much. Any other comments, concerns, or questions from any interested person or entity? With that, we'll proceed to commissioner or advisor comments or questions. I would just, you know, ask to Ms. Forney, you know, we do this on an annual basis. Is what you've recommended different in any substantive way from what we have done in recent years?
It is exactly what we've done as far back as I can remember. This is the exact same levy that we had. It's the maximum that we can assess based on SDCL 49-1A-4, I think. And we do have that $250 minimum, and that's been in place again forever.
Another question, Dusty Johnson here. I believe under state law, do we have some cap of that fund? And we're not approaching that cap, is that right?
We do have a cap, and based on my calculations, we're still about $900,000 below that cap.
We're unlikely to get there this year, then.
Correct.
All right. Any other comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? Yeah, Commissioner Kolbeck.
Yes, Heather, are we having any trouble collecting this money? Is everything up to date up until this point?
We haven't started collecting yet. I was going on the assumption that you would go
ahead and assess the levy as I've recommended, and the bills will go out this afternoon to those companies. They're not due yet. So we do have some companies that have already paid their $250 minimum because they know that's what they're going to owe. But if we do have any problems collecting, those will be typically some of the telecommunications companies, and those are the ones that go on right about the end of the calendar year, first part of next calendar year, for the revocation of their certificates of authority for non-payment.
We've got some in the room, so if you give us their names, we can maybe get a check before they go out the door. Thank you, Heather.
You're welcome.
Other comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, anyone have a motion?
A motion that today the commission established the rate and access the gross receipts tax is authorized in South Dakota Codified Law 49-1A-3 with the recommendations from staff.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Ms. Forney.
Thank you.
Now, we're going to go back to the top of our agenda, or close to the top. Consumer complaints, item number one, CE07-001. And this deals with the complaint by Michael McCrite from Mitchell against Northwestern Energy regarding utility service refusal. The question for the commission today is, shall the commission dismiss the complaint and close the docket? I think perhaps it would be most appropriate to look to staff, Ms. Gregor, Ms. Van Bakkeren, for their comments before hearing from the parties.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Cara Van Bakkeren for staff. I've been in personal contact with Mr. McCrite, and he no longer desires electric service at that location. I would ask that his complaint be dismissed.
Thanks, Ms. Van Bakkeren. Is Mr. McCrite, anyone representing him, or Northwestern, wish to make any comments?
McCrite had a lease from the owner of the Stardust Motel. That's apparently evaporated, and now the owner of the Stardust has entered into a purchase agreement for the property with yet another person. So McCrite is out of the situation, and we're working with the guy to restore service to the property if it hasn't been done yet, and I haven't had an update in the last couple of days. So I think it's totally appropriate that this dock could be closed, and appreciate your consideration of this matter going back over the past month.
Thanks, Mr. Kennecke. Ms. Van Bakkeren.
Mr. Solom and I actually stopped by the motel yesterday, and in fact, the new owner was there. He was cleaning. It appeared as if he had electric service. I think Northwestern's working with him, and it sounds like a closing date has come and gone, and the hotel's been sold. So it's a good situation for everyone, I believe.
Thanks very much. Any comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? Commissioner Colbeck.
I'll move to dismiss the complaint and close the docket in CE07-001.
Motion's been made. No seconds required. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. That will proceed to electric item number one. It's in the matter of the application of Xcel Energy for a construction permit to build 9.6 miles of the Split Rock to Lakefield Junction 345 kV transmission line and add facilities at the Split Rock substation. And the question today for the commission is, shall it approve the motion to extend the final approval deadline? And at this time, we'd look to Xcel. Anyone from Xcel to explain their motion?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Xcel Energy in this matter. As the commission knows, the particular line in question is just north of where we're located here in Sioux Falls, and it's a 345 kV line, which is primarily needed to bring wind power from the location of the wind farms southeast of Brookings. The location of the poles has been approved by the DOT. We are still having some discussions with the South Dakota DOT and the federal DOT as to the proper configuration of the poles. We still believe that we're going to get it negotiated. There are some federal issues that are being explored right now on that subject, and we simply need some more time to arrive at that final agreement. As far as the location of the poles, it's all approved. It simply is the configuration of the poles. And with that, I'll turn it over to staff, see if Ms. Kramer has anything.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. The staff would agree with Xcel's take on this docket. There really is no harm in extending it another 6 months. It would seem bureaucratic on our part to close, deny, dismiss the docket at this point when they are very close to having it completed. So we would recommend approval of the motion to extend.
Thanks very much, Ms. Kramer. Questions or comments? All right. Hearing none, I would move that the commission approve the motion to extend the final approval deadline. The motion's been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. Item number two is EL06-020, and this deals with the application that Navitas has made for energy conversion facility permit for the White Wind Farm and associated collection substation and electric interconnection system. And today we actually, before the commission, is the approval of a settlement stipulation and whether or not the commission will approve the construction permit. Settlement stipulation has been filed, and I forget who ended up filing it, which party did. But. Okay. Does anybody, any particular party, want to address the settlement stipulation first?
My name is Chris Moore. I work for Navitas Energy.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Moore. Thanks.
Karen has given me the opportunity to address the stipulation first. I'm here with Doug Copeland of our office and also David Gertis, who is our attorney representative in this matter. The White Wind Farm is a 200-megawatt wind farm in Brookings County. We've had some public meetings with the commission regarding this facility, so I'm assuming that some of the generalities about the project the commission is familiar with. One of the items that was completed about this project was we are interconnecting at the Western Area Power Authority White substation, again in Brookings County. That required us to complete a federal environmental impact statement, which has now been complete. At this point, we believe it is entirely appropriate for the state to act in this matter, and we request that they do so. We have completed the stipulation as requested or as required, and we're ready for action by the PUC.
Thanks very much. Any other party to the stipulation wish to address it? Mm-hmm. All right. Apparently, everybody, the stipulation does speak for itself. Then, any questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Thought it was a very clear and clean stipulation. I mean, it is tough to find very much awful environmental impact when it's laid out quite this cleanly. So, I did think it was interesting how much earthquake activity has been located in this part of the county. You don't normally think of Moody County as earthquake central, but 3.5 to 4.0, that's not insignificant. So, any other questions or comments?
Can I ask a question, Mr.
Yeah.
Chairman?
Go ahead.
I just was curious, and I apologize you're behind me here, but I guess I'm on TV, so. But on the lighting, I notice a lot of these are not going to have aircraft warning lights on them. Maybe could you give us an indication of what that's all about? And
yes, I can. The FAA has a requirement for lighting on every wind turbine, except in the matter of wind farms, where they do allow you to submit a request for perimeter lighting. And to the extent that the FAA finds that acceptable, they will allow you to reduce the number of lights in the wind farm area. That's more less to do with the obstruction. It has to do with the convenience or being responsive to the neighbors in the area.
Mr. Smith, does that answer your question?
It does. I had one other one, but go ahead if you had something else.
Oh, go ahead.
I guess my other one was on the letter of credit and the seeming discrepancy between the $4.9 million and the numbers that are on the exhibit to the stipulation, and maybe a word of explanation as to that from staff or from Navitas. Or did I just misunderstand something?
Mr. Smith, this is Nathan Sullivan with staff. Could you restate your question, please?
I'm looking at paragraph 18. And I may have just misunderstood. I haven't obviously been involved in this much, but what's it? Yes. Paragraph 19 of the, I think it's the conditions or something, and there's a requirement to maintain a $4.9 million letter of credit. And the numbers on the exhibit in the back are bigger than that, and I was just curious as to what the basis for that number is. And maybe I'm just misunderstanding the exhibit too on cost, but it looked like there was $9.5 million in cost.
The
commissioning.
Mr. Smith, mm-hmm. the presumption here was that the salvage value of the turbines would cover that portion of the cost, which is about half of the $9.5 million. So the letter of credit was to cover the resurfacing or the recontouring of the land and removal of the roads and that kind of thing that's involved in decommissioning.
Thank you.
That's the difference.
That makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Dusty Johnson here again. I did have a couple of questions on noise, and I note the stipulation notes that 1,000 feet is the closest, I think, that any turbine would be to a residence. Have there been concerns by landowners in the area about this project and noise? And are they comfortable with where we're at?
We've heard we've had no objections to the 1,000, and everybody in the area, I believe, is aware of the placement of the turbine.
I'm looking for it, but did I see 50 decibels at 1,000 feet out?
That's correct.
Okay. And can you give us some idea, you know, I think most of us have seen charts indicating what's 40 decibels and what's 60 decibels. Can you give us an idea of what 50 decibels, what an equivalent to that would be? Is that a primary highway? Is that...
My understanding is right now if we would all stop speaking, this room would be at about 50 decibels.
Fair enough. The last question doesn't seem very loud, does it?
There's nothing implied by that at all.
We have long known that John Smith is a heavy breather.
Sign of youth.
Cigarettes.
Yeah. The other question I've got deals with, and somewhere in the stipulation it talked about concerns by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I think about native unbroken sod. And I know you'd moved the location of some turbines as a result of that. I mean, do they have veto power over this project? Were there recommendations that were made by U.S. Fish and Wildlife?
What I would suggest is we just completed the federal environmental impact statement, of which they were a part of this, and they are I don't want to say they are a signatory, but they have approval rights as part of that EIS docket, and we have just received it has been signed. We have a record of decision, so they were a part of that. They have approved everything that has been put in place, and I believe a majority of the stipulations that are included here were also parts of that document.
So even though 1WTG is still on a native prairie parcel, they're fine with that because of the other mitigating steps you took?
I don't want to blame Brookings County, but the reason we can't move it is because it would be right next to the road and there's county setbacks. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service did understand that, and part of our permit with them is actually putting money into a pool that we use to purchase grassland easements on other parcels that are not currently under easement but are on broken sod.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other questions or comments by commissioners or advisors?
This is Commissioner Kovac. I'd just like to hear from the county board. They drove all the way here. Is there one of your representatives that could like to speak on that, give me your opinion?
I guess, yeah, Dennis Falcon. I served as chair of the local review committee for the project, and approximately a year ago we went through this process, and I guess we have worked very closely with our planning department, and Bob Hill from our planning and zoning is here, so I think we feel we've, you know, have all our questions answered, reference this project.
You feel comfortable with this project going forward then?
Absolutely.
I know we said at the time that we looked at the local review committee report, but I just think those are invaluable. The commission gives those a lot of weight, and we appreciate everybody who participated in that process. I should see if anybody else from the affected area has any questions or comments. Okay. Any other commissioner advisor comments or questions? With that, we'll motion is in order.
Commissioner Johnson, if I
might. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Kramer.
No, that's fine. I just, before you make your motion, staff would recommend approval of the stipulation and the granting of the construction permit. But as a part of that, SDREA wants to make sure that we include the stipulation that they came up with, that you guys approved on May 22nd, that be incorporated as part of the order in this. And I told them that it would be. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks very much, Ms. Kramer. With that, I would go ahead and move that the commission approve the settlement stipulation and the commission approve the construction permit, and the commission would also note that the stipulation that was filed earlier, May 15th, by the looks of it, would also be a part of the settlement stipulation. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Well, probably worth noting this is it's great news. More development for Brookings County, and I think we're looking at 10 to 12 jobs, I think the settlement stipulation said, and good to see renewable energy become more a part of the South Dakota landscape. So, any other comments?
What's the completion schedule?
I'm sorry?
When is the schedule to be completed?
Right now we're forecasting to start work in 2008.
Start work in 2008.
Correct.
And is it a 12-month process? You'll be turning by the end of the summer? Or?
We have high hopes. There's other things that impact that, but right now we're forecast to start construction in 2008. Right. And hopefully it'll be complete in 2008 or 2009.
Fantastic. Thank you.
The only caution, Mr. Chairman, that I would try to make as a commissioner is not to fall all over myself welcoming you. We're very excited to have wind development in South Dakota, so we're glad to see that you're able to get through all the hoops and that the transmission process is on track, and look forward to you continuing your construction process throughout the state of South Dakota.
Thank you, Commissioner.
We've got another 400 miles across the state there.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will say that I believe this is one of the most well-studied wind farms in the history of wind farms.
I'm not sure that qualifies as a compliment. So, thanks very much. The motion has been made. Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much to everyone. With that, we will move to agenda item number 3 under electricity, EL07-019. It's in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation for approval of a contract with deviations with Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railroad. Shall the commission approve the contract with deviations and associated tariff revisions? Anyone from Northwestern care to make any comments? Mr. Decker.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Jeff Decker with Northwestern Energy. Today, Northwestern seeks approval of this contract with deviation, which will allow Northwestern to recover the cost of this project from the customer. The project is the railroad's installing two track heaters, and the track heaters will have minimal use because obviously it's just during the winter time under certain conditions, so that to keep the tracks free. This will require an installation of 3,500 feet of cable, some transformers and other related equipment. And again, we're just attempting to recover costs from the customer with the minimal use. There'll be minimal revenue to offset the cost. So we're looking to recover this from the customer.
Thanks very much, Mr. Decker. We look to staff, Mr. Jacobson, Ms. Kramer, for their comments.
Yes, this is Dave Jacobson. I have nothing to add. I just recommend approval.
Thanks very much. Any questions or comments? Commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, I'll move that the commission approve the contract with deviations and the associated tariff provisions. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. Item number four is EL07-020, and this deals with an electric service territory boundary change between Clay Union and Northwestern. Today, shall the commission approve the electric service territory boundary change? We'll look to either anyone from Clay Union or Northwestern if they have any comments, and if not, we would look to staff.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem with staff. Northwestern Energy and Clay Union Electric Cooperative have jointly filed for transfer of a three-phase electric service location that's in the east half of the southeast quarter, Section 18, Township 94 North, Range 54 West of the 5th Prime Meridian in Yankton County. Clay Union would have to build 2 miles of three-phase line to serve this new irrigation service in their territory, while Northwestern Energy has three-phase within a half a mile of the location. Transfer of this service to Northwestern will result in the elimination of duplication of service and promotes the efficient and economical use and development of the electrical systems of the said utilities. This transfer is limited to this three-phase service only and not to any additional load in said location. No existing customers or electric facilities are affected by this proposal. The owner of the affected property has agreed in writing to this proposal. Staff recommends approval of this request as it avoids unnecessary duplication of facilities, provides adequate electric service to the customer affected, and promotes the efficient and economical use and development of the electrical systems of the utilities as outlined in SDCL 4934A55 for such exceptions. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Solem. Any comments or questions? Commissioners, advisors? Well, I know there's some debate about exactly what the Territory Act means in South Dakota, but I think this is certainly consistent with any reading of it. So, anyone have a motion?
Move for approval of 020 to approve the electric service territory boundary change.
Motion's been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much.
Normally, you'd ask if the homeowner is okay with it, but he requested it. So.
Yeah, that's right. Natural gas portion of the agenda is NG06-011. It's in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation for approval of tariff revisions. And the question for the commission today is simply, will it approve the tariff revisions? We'll look first to Northwestern.
Good morning. Jeff Decker again with Northwestern. I'll give some introductory comments, and if there's detailed questions, Clyde Gross and Dennis Hines are on the line as well to answer questions. This is a tariff revision requiring third-party marketers to obtain credit approval prior to beginning service on Northwestern system. Northwestern currently has 2 marketers on our system. With this filing, Northwestern seeks or obtain approval to determine creditworthiness of marketers on our system. Due to the volatility in the gas market, Northwestern seeks to ensure the customers and Northwestern are protected in the event of payment default. Monthly imbalance amounts have reached up to $500,000. Although imbalances to this amount are not the norm, Northwestern seeks protection in the event of such cost. Cornerstone Energy intervened in the case, and Northwestern and Cornerstone have negotiated their differences and are in agreement regarding this filing. In addition, at Cornerstone's request, Northwestern agreed to insert language to provide intraday meter reads to the marketers. This change will provide better use information to the marketer and improve their opportunity to balance their customer usage on our system. Today, Northwestern seeks approval of this credit requirement tariff filing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think there was an intervener. Yes, looks like Cornerstone Energy. Anyone from Cornerstone Energy have any comments? Hearing none, we will move towards staff. Mr. Jacobson, Ms. Van Bakker, any comments?
This is Dave Jacobson. We have no further comments. We just recommend approval.
Thanks very much. Does anyone, Mr. Jacobson, have you spoke with anybody from Cornerstone Energy? Do they have any concerns still pending about this action?
I did earlier, but not since the stipulation has been agreed to. But I'm sure they would have contacted me if there were any concerns. But it is agreement between the parties.
Sure. Okay. Thanks very much. Any other comments or questions by commissioners or staff?
Mr. Jacobson, recommended approval.
Mr. Jacobson, you recommended approval? I didn't hear that part.
Yes.
Hearing no questions, I'll move that the commission approve the tariff revisions. Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Next item under natural gas is NG07-013. It's in the matter of the application by Northwestern Corporation, doing business as Northwestern Energy, for authority to increase its natural gas rates. The question before the commission today is, shall the commission suspend the imposition of the tariff for 90 days beyond July 1st, 2007, and shall the commission assess a filing fee for actual expenses not to exceed $100,000? And finally, shall the commission approve the proposed consulting contract? At this time, we would look toward to staff for their comments.
Yes, this is Dave Jacobson from commission staff. These are the regular activities that we undertake at the beginning of a rate case. One thing I should mention is that actually the commission does not yet have the contract before them. What we are requesting is the ability to contract pursuant to the provisions in the proposal that is. Can you hear me at all?
Yes, go ahead.
What we are requesting is that you give us permission to contract pursuant to the proposal that has been forwarded to you.
So perhaps a motion to authorize the executive director to enter into such a contract would be acceptable, Mr. Jacobson?
Yeah, you will end up signing the contract. It's just that right now we just want to we want permission to go ahead and forward that contract to you when it's ready.
So what would be the appropriate motion?
Well, previously it's just shall the commission give approval to allow staff to enter into a contract.
Okay. Okay, fine. All right, thanks, Mr. Jacobson. Does Northwestern have any comments or concerns about these actions?
Brett Kennedy for Northwestern. No, commissioners, we have no concerns. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Any questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Hearing. Commissioner Colbeck?
This is just kind of the kickoff to putting the lipstick on the pig, right? This is how we're going to start this rate case.
It is only in the world of the regulatory sector that a filing that actually assessing a filing fee is considered lipstick.
On a pig.
Yeah.
Commissioner, this is Greg Rislev, and I've heard that term used many, many times before at the beginning of a rate case.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Yes. All right. Hearing none, anyone have a motion?
Do you want all three of these covered?
Yeah.
In NG07-017, I move that the commission suspend the imposition of the tariff for 90 days beyond July 1, 2007, The commission assess a filing fee for actual expenses not to exceed $100,000, and that the commission approve the proposed staff entering into a consulting contract.
Motion's been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hanson.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you very much. We have handled telecommunications item number one. We will proceed to number two, which is TC07-020. It deals with the filing made by Matrix Telecom for an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates. Today, shall the commission approve the interstate switched access tariff, and shall the commission grant the petition and waivers requested by Matrix Telecom? I think it would be best to look at staff. Look to staff, Mr. Best and Ms. Kramer, for their initial comments.
This is Harlan Best of staff. Administrative Rule 2010-2707 requires a company to file a cost study every 3 years. Matrix is filing a request for waiver of the three-year requirement. They are also requesting a waiver of 2010-2712 from having their rates based on the average telecommunications company with less than 100,000 access lines as determined within a cost study. This would, in turn, allow Matrix to mirror the Quest intrastate switched access rate, and also that it file adjustments to its switched access rates, so long as those adjustments either mirror Quest Corp's rate or are lower than the Quest Corporation rate until ordered by the commission to do otherwise. Staff would also recommend that the intrastate switched access tariff be approved.
Thanks very much, Mr. Best. Anybody from Matrix on the line or in peer? Any commissioner, advisor comments or questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Best, this is Gary Hansen. In South Dakota, is it, in just about all circumstances, is it looked upon as being favorable for a business to mirror the rates of Quest?
In that is the general location, that is the location where these competitive LECs are operating, is in within the Quest territory, yes. Because usually their costs are higher than Quest.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
I have one. This is Commissioner Colbeck. Mr. Bass, is there a rate lower than that, or this is the this is the best rate that we could probably do for these customers, correct? Or for to give Matrix, this is the lowest rate that they can take or use?
Well, this would be what Matrix would do is they would mirror Quest intrastate switched access rate, and they would charge that to other long-distance carriers that use Matrix.
And what is the Quest rate right now? What has it been?
It's 6.09 cents per minute.
This is Keith Sanger. If I may interject for a second.
Sure.
The rule actually allows the companies to take the average schedule rate of all those companies under 100,000 access lines. So that would be the LECA plus rate. The LECA plus rate is about twice the amount as the Quest rate. So it is very advantageous for keeping switched access rates down for them to accept the Quest rates, if that helps any.
Yep, that's exactly what I wanted to know, Keith. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Hearing none, anyone have any action?
I'll motion in TC07020 that the commission approve the switched access tariff and grant the petition and waivers requested by Matrix Telecom, doing business as Matrix Business Technologies.
Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck.
Aye.
Hanson.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. Telecom item number three is in the matter of the filing for approval of an amendment to an interconnection agreement between Quest and Comtel Telecom Assets LP. Today, shall the commission approve the amendment to the agreement? Anyone from staff have any comments about this?
This is Karen Kramer from staff, and Quest is in the room if they would like to comment. Staff, however, would state that the amendment was properly filed, executed, does not appear to contain any discriminatory language, and no comments were filed. Staff, therefore, recommends approval of the amendment.
Thanks very much, Ms. Kramer. Anyone from Comtel Telecom Assets or Quest wish to make any comments?
This is Colleen Siebold representing Quest. We have no comments.
Great. Thanks very much, Ms. Siebold. Any other comments? Okay. Any commissioner or advisor questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll move that the commission approve the amendment to the agreement. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Canson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecommunications item number four deals with a large number of certifications regarding the use of federal universal service funds. I don't know how most efficiently to deal with these. I wonder if we should see if staff, first look to staff. I'm trying to decide whether or not to take them as a whole or take them individually. Anybody have any recommendations? Ms. Kramer, I can see you, so why don't you go first?
I would say this is Karen Kramer from staff. These are, in my opinion, relatively easy filings. Harlan could probably cover them all at once, but I wonder if Ms. Wiest, maybe, if she has particular questions about particular dockets, pull those out.
Yeah.
This is Roland. I think Harlan could have just covered them all at the same time.
Okay, let's go ahead and do that. Let's begin by having Mr. Best or Ms. Kramer or anybody else on staff pull out any particular comments that they'd like with any of these dockets. Then we can see if any of the companies have any particular comments about their dockets, and we can also pull out any commissioner questions about any of them. So, Mr. Best, any concerns on any of these filings?
This is Harlan Best of staff. The respective companies filed in accordance with the Commission Administrative Rules for certification of federal universal service support. They have certified the use of the support, that it is, they will use the money consistent with the federal universal service provisions set forth in federal code. And staff would recommend that the commission send certification to the FCC and to USAC.
Mr. Best, any particular questions or concerns or interesting facts that you feel a need to highlight for the commission on any of these dockets?
No, I think the companies were very straightforward in responding to the commission rules.
Great, thanks. Do any of the companies wish to make any comment? I do see we have Mr. Roth here. We'll click telephone. Any comments?
I do not have any comments, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks. Any other companies wish to make any comments? I would, any commissioner comments or questions, and I would just note, you know, that when you take a look at all of these taken as a whole, I think it's striking how much investment is going on in rural South Dakota. These are by and large rural companies and obviously receiving universal service funds, and it's amazing the amount of fiber that is flowing to communities and quite a great deal of investment. So, and other than that, I didn't see anything in particular that I need to question or pull out. Other commissioner or advisor comments or questions?
Yeah, this is Commissioner Colbeck. I'd like to echo the sentiments. I think it's fantastic that this money is being used, what it's being used for, and not just fiber to the communities, but fiber to the home, and that's definitely going to hopefully help South Dakota in the future with economic gains.
Well, and again, when you look at them taken, Dusty Johnson here, when you look at them taken as a whole, I think it's amazing how big the difference is between universal service funds flowing in and then how much larger the number is actual improvements and costs of maintaining rural networks. Clearly, there's a lot of money. I think sometimes people believe that it's just USF that is building out and maintaining rural networks. That is very clearly not the case when you look at these filings. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, I think it would be acceptable to make a motion in each of these dockets, but I guess I would look to our legal counsels to make sure that that is acceptable. Ms. Wiest, Mr. Smith? Ms. Wiest?
Yes, that would be fine.
Okay, great. I would move that the Commission provide a certification to the Federal Communications Commission and to USAC regarding the plan for the use of Federal Universal Services support as proposed in each of the above dockets. And just for the record, those dockets are TC07-035, 037, 040, 043, 046, 048, 049, 050, 051, and 053. Motion's been made, and unless anybody sees that I missed one, we'll proceed to any discussion on the motion. Hearing none, we'll proceed to a vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We've handled telecom item number 5. We'll proceed to telecom item number 6, which is TC07-077, in the matter of the filing for approval of an amendment to an interconnection agreement between Quest Corporation and Holton Enterprises, which does business as guaranteed phone service. Today, shall the Commission approve the amendment to the agreement? Perhaps we would look first to Ms. Van Bakkern for her comments.
Thank you. This is Kara Van Bakkern. The amendment was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain any discriminatory language. There were no interveners in this docket, and staff therefore recommends approval.
Anyone from Guaranteed Phone Service or Quest Corporation wish to make any comments?
This is Colleen Siebold for Quest. We have no comments.
Thank you very much, Ms. Siebold. Any commissioner or advisor comments or questions? All right. Hearing none, anyone have a motion?
In TC07-077, I will move that the commission approve the amendment to the agreement.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we will proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. That completes our regularly scheduled agenda meeting. There are a series of announcements describing the upcoming commission meetings. People can get that online or out front of the commission office. At this point, we will proceed to the addendum of the agenda, which deals with just one item, I believe, and that is the under hydrocarbon pipeline HP07-001, in the matter of the filing of the application of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline for a siting permit, construction permit rather. The question before the commission today deals with confidentially filed documents. Shall the commission accept staff's recommendations regarding the confidentially filed documents, or in the alternative, how shall the commission proceed? There was a letter filed by a commission attorney, Kara Van Bakkern, and perhaps we'll start there. Ms. Van Bakkern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Van Bakkern for staff. I did file a letter on June 21 in which I hope to outline the progress that we made with TransCanada in releasing confidentially filed documents. Staff received the release documents on June 15th. By June 20th, we had it up on the website. And regardless of whether or not it should or shouldn't have been marked confidential, that's ancient history at this point. It's out to the public. The public has access to all of it. There are very few documents that have been kept confidential, and many of those are from other states, and it involves culturally sensitive areas and environmental areas. And again, I'll just reiterate that those South Dakota documents that are continue to remain confidential are very limited, and TransCanada has relied on other federal agencies or federal law in marking them as such, and I believe it's our duty as a commission to keep such documents confidential. So I would recommend the commissioners accept the filing as is, and we continue to protect those documents that remain marked as confidential.
Thanks, Ms. Van Bakkern. Before taking questions, perhaps we could turn to TransCanada and see if they have any comments with regarding Ms. Van Bakkern's letter.
Good morning, Commissioners. Brett Kennecke for TransCanada. We appreciate staff's letter that was filed and staff's comments here today. I think it's fair to say that we regret that this happened, but I do want to reiterate for your benefit and the benefit of anybody who might be listening, the information which was marked confidential was done out of high regard for the public interest. the public's interest in keeping things confidential as outlined by other units of government, whether they be federal or state, with respect to high consequence areas, with respect to cultural and archaeological resources and endangered species. We were zealous in guarding that public interest, and we reviewed that and came up with the revised filing, which I think meets the guidelines in all respects. Despite the claims of some people, there's nothing in that material related to the proposed oil refinery at Elk Point or anything else with respect to TransCanada. In every respect, the confidential filings had to do with things that other units of government demanded that, and requested that we keep confidential, and we tried to respect that public interest. So we think we're over that. I hate to say this, we do have more information to provide to the citizens of South Dakota even after 12 hours of hearings yesterday, but we have more information to provide specifically to the county auditor's offices as is required, but we're getting there and we're working through this, and I appreciate the commission's indulgence in the work that staff has had to put into this matter, and we hope that we're past this at this point. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Kennecke. We do have a number of people who have been granted party status. We'll pause for a moment to see if they have any comments on Ms. Ann Bochran's letter. Hearing none, Mr. Kennecke, you did note the 12 hours of hearings. At one time, somebody mentioned to me, Brett Kennecke, the more time you spend with him, the more you'll get to like him. I'm not sure that's been the case. Perhaps it's just been the nature of the meetings.
I'll refrain from commenting on the record, but thank you for your comment, Commissioner.
You know, let's go ahead and move to commissioner or advisor comments or questions. I have a couple, but if my colleagues have some, they can certainly. Yeah. Let's start with Ms. Van Bakken with the pipeline landowner list containing confidential personal information. I understand why the personal information wouldn't be published, but was this an item that is totally confidential or one that's been redacted?
It has been kept completely confidential at this point, and I know staff would certainly be willing to go through and redact all addresses and phone number information unless TransCanada would like to keep individual landowner names private for any particular reason.
I mean, I don't know that it makes a huge difference to me. Certainly that's publicly available information. You can go to the county courthouse and find out who has entitled to a particular piece of land. It does seem that we've had some questions about this particular item, and because it doesn't fit plainly into the cultural environmental rationales that have been given, I thought we should at least throw it out for discussion.
You know, I appreciate the tenor of the discussion. It's not an easy or simple question, and it's just been our position up to this point that list is a very complete document with respect to people's really personal information, and if the commission feels it has to put it out, that'll be the commission's decision, but we don't, I'd hate to say that it's over our objection, but we just don't think that in this day and age that's something that, you know, when we file lawsuits at state court, we have to file redacted personal information on people so that somebody reviewing the public records up at the courthouse can't find out people's social security number, you know, phone number, so on and so forth, and it's not uncommon to hold that back. If you decide otherwise, that's your decision.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Kennecke. I you know, would also ask Ms. Van Bochran about, or and Mr. Kennecke, you know, we've got a number of these documents that are still confidential. To what extent could redaction be a tool to move these documents from completely confidential to, I mean, even if you might have whole pages or whole paragraphs blacked out, is that a mechanism that could be used additionally to at least allow people to believe they're getting access to every possible bit of information?
On the pump station list or on the...
On any of the items that are on page 2 of Ms. Van Bochran's letter and that you have filed. There are still some documents that are completely confidential and a redaction has not been a tool that's been used. Was that because the document just would have been worthless with that much information redacted out?
That's my understanding, Commissioner, that we've reached the level of redaction that's possible under the structure of the documents, the rules under which and the requests under which we've been operating. We're at the limit, is my understanding.
You know, and I make that, I ask that question and make that suggestion. I mean, I think that's... I suspect that's right. I mean, I'm not dealing. Now my concerns aren't on the public policy sector. My concerns really are on the public perception perspective. In that sometimes even if you can see that a whole paragraph's blacked out, the context around the paragraph will allow you to understand, okay, this isn't anything. They really aren't talking about Gorilla. You know, this really is a document that is just describing the Topeka Shiner. And so, and I don't know, and I haven't gone through all of these documents yet and looked at the confidential versions and tried to imagine where would I redact if I was an environmental and cultural expert. So I just thought I would offer it up to get TransCanada's take on have we bored down to the deepest level, and perhaps Suzanne Bachran, your opinion on that would be appreciated.
I think, this is Caravan Bachran, a significant portion of those documents kept confidential are maps. And I don't know what good it would do to black out all the locations of particular cultural material or environmental material. So I think a lot of them are maps, and significant portion too are maps of highly sensitive areas where, according to the federal pipeline agencies, the entire map is confidential. So they simply can't be as a whole document released. And then I would echo that. I think the documents would be would not be useful at all to the landowners with the redactions that are necessary. And I understand the public perception is very important in this docket, but the documents that we're talking about are specific to environmental and cultural aspects that do not affect the landowner's ability to protect their rights as landowners.
Well, thanks, Ms. Van Bachran. And you do note, in your letter that we have received some information from both state and federal officials indicating the sensitivity of this information. So, I think Commissioner Hansen at our last meeting, made it very clear, the commission really wants a legal underpinning for any of this information to be kept confidential, whether that's state or federal rules or laws. And it appears as though TransCanada has tried to operate in accordance with his articulation of that. One other thing that occurs to me, reasonable people can probably disagree about whether or not a particular document could be further redacted. It is worth noting again for the record that, we've got a large number of interveners, any of which presumably could enter into some sort of an agreement, a protective order, so that they could take a look at it. And if they believe that information that they have access to, the broader public should have access to, they could certainly, by their own action, petition the commission to examine this issue further. That's my understanding. I've looked at the lawyers to make sure I haven't misstated anything.
I think that's true. I mean, the commission very frequently permits parties to cases to have full access to all confidential information. It's just that they have to do so under some understanding that it won't be totally released out to the public. Again, I think, we get great benefits at the commission from the Internet, from electronic filing and the tremendous amount of availability of information we can provide. But it also makes the information extremely broadly available, to a universe of people that, is way beyond what normally we might have looked upon traditionally as people likely to come into our office and seek access to information. And I might one observation on the landowner list, and again, maybe that's the toughest item. I just note here that in other cases, I'll give you an example, a recent one, S&S Communications, for example, where people out there they haven't elected to come to the commission. This is something that came to them. And all of a sudden, then, to have your information not just in our files, but on the Internet, where everybody in the world can make up a list and do a mass mailing. I think that's the kind of concerns we've had, in some of these things, is that a lot of times people, when they haven't voluntarily elected to be in something, to then all of a sudden subject them to public display is maybe a reason to think about not doing that. And particularly, obviously, if there's identity-type information involved. But just some thoughts.
No, thanks, Mr. Smith. It is probably worth noting, we did have a couple of public hearings on other issues regarding this docket yesterday, and this information's only been available for a week, but I mean, I do think it was good to see that a number of people quoted from information that they'd found on the Internet that had previously been marked confidential. A number of people mentioned that they appreciated having access to this information. And clearly there is hundreds and hundreds of pages for people to review out there. I think people appreciate having access to those documents. So, any other commissioner or advisor comments or questions? Yeah, Commissioner Colbeck.
Yes. I guess I'm looking at the letter from the Department of State. I understand the environmental consequences and why we have to do that because it's more on the federal side. I'm more concerned with the, and I'll look to staff, I guess, for an answer to this question. Is there anything that someone could go to the courthouse for and spend hours upon hours of research to find out that is marked confidential here? That's more of my concern is, well, I can get it at the courthouse, but I can't get it on your website type of a deal.
The landowner list, Commissioner, is the only thing I can think. I suppose someone could find the site. They could go to the Register of Deeds office. They could look up parcel by parcel the owner. That would be the only type of information I can think that would be accessible in a different venue. And
that is public information.
It's just organized in such a way, as I think Mr. Smith articulated well, that we're really giving it to people. With,
yeah.
I mean, I feel uncomfortable in giving that entire list, but that would be a type of information that is public. I mean, land ownership is a public recorded type of instrument at the Register of Deeds. So.
Is there a way that we could... I'm uncomfortable with that being on the Internet. I'll be blatant about that. Very much understand that information being on the Internet and the ramifications of that. Is there any way that TransCanada would be willing to help landowners back to the county courthouses? Maybe the landowner list is at the county courthouse and not on the Internet? Is that legally a problem, John?
Well, there's really no cut and dried. If you look at our rule, which you guys probably don't have a copy of, there's no cut and dried category. There's a group of categories on here. One of the categories is trade secrets, you know, and we've got information which is made confidential under any other provisions of state or federal law. And I'm not aware of any particular federal privacy law or whatever. I mean, we're not dealing with medical information or any of that here. But the last category is information which is determined confidential by the commission. And, to me, it gets down to just what level of disclosure of people's, and I just don't know. It's up to you. I mean,
yeah.
Probably most of these people are listening to the phone book. It's up to you. Do you want, if you feel you want to, we've elected, like in the S&S case, we elected not to reveal all of those customer names and what out to the and put a list of them on the public. And again, there's reasons for doing that, for putting them on there. And there's the reason for not doing so is because these people aren't choosing to get a mailing from us. And all of a sudden you're on a list, somebody can go on there, and all of a sudden you're getting more junk mail in the mail. And it might be a good thing. But it might be something that I think it's a discretionary deal.
I think it's kind of concerning that the Raptor has more confidentiality than a person who owns land. But
Raptor doesn't even get junk mail.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
This is Greg Russell with the commission staff. One thing I wanted to point out that if people really felt they wanted their name in public, I think there's a list of over 100 interveners, and it'd probably be a pretty good guess that that would be a list of landowners who would choose to make their names public, and likely it would be a majority of the people along that route. And I would suggest that alone would likely represent a list of those who would, I guess, who have no objection to having their name mentioned in public, and that may serve as, at least in some sense, a substitute for the information you're talking about now.
Mr. Hansen had a comment or question.
Well, I did, and I do, but it's one of those situations that you, out of a 12-hour meeting, you might say one sentence, and then it gets quoted wrong. there's
The S&S situation was one in which people had been bilked out of significant amount of funds, and they, some of them were embarrassed and some of them were in situations where they had businesses and they didn't want the rest of the world to know that they had been duped out of thousands of dollars. So there was an entirely different reason at that juncture for having those confidential. The situation that we have here is that it's interesting because one of the gentlemen that I spoke with yesterday when we were in Alexandria only wanted to give me his first name. He was very concerned about government and government at every level and what they might do to him. And at the same time, there were several people that came up to speak with me at the breaks who wanted to know, and these are landowners, wanted to know, is there a list of names so that we can kind of get together and set up each one of us hiring different attorneys. Maybe we can all get together and hire or a bunch of us in different areas and hire attorneys and share the cost. And so there's pros and cons here, different challenges. And I suspect most of these folks have their name in a phone book somewhere. And if someone really wants to go through the process of sending them letters, all they've got to do is go to the county courthouse or drive down the road and they can do it. Granted, that's a little more difficult than picking it off the internet. But there are some advantages to these folks in being able to know who else is in the boat with them and how they can contact those people and work with them. Some of the people were asking for sign-up sheets yesterday. So, you know, we've got to recognize that there's benefits to these folks, too, to having their names a part of it. And if we're insisting on open government, then it would seem to make sense to have it open.
Yeah, Commissioner Hansen, this is Dusty Johnson. You know, I think you're right. I mean, I understand the dangers of this, but a suggestion that I might make to the commissioners is perhaps we could ask TransCanada to provide only the list of landowners and the town of residence. The mailing address that person is sent to. That way, if somebody knows, the John Smith from Canova may be different than the John Smith from Carthage, and if we help them narrow that down, I can see a public interest benefit from people at least knowing who's affected by this pipeline. I would maybe pause to see if staff or TransCanada have any objections to that.
This is Kara Van Bachman for staff. Staff does not have any objections to that and would certainly work with TransCanada to redact that information, but it appears as if they may have some comments.
The commission orders that we'll do it.
Well, if TransCanada believes we're doing the wrong thing, we want to know that too.
That is a concern. I'm not used to it. I guess what I'd like to say is we're...
Hello? Yeah, we're just pausing for a moment while they discuss.
That's still the bottom line. If the commission orders it, that's what we'll do. You've listed the competing concerns here very well, and you've framed it up. And if it's done, it won't be at our request or our agreement. If you tell us to do it, we'll do it. It's the best I can do for you, Commissioner.
Well, thanks, Mr. Kennecke, and I appreciate that. We'll pause for a moment again. TransCanada is doing some... Yeah, could you go ahead and... Yeah.
Sorry. TransCanada, I would just like to clarify that the concern is the experiences, as John Smith has identified, where these people are not voluntarily wanting their information put on broadcast. This has been an issue... in other jurisdictions, and I just want to be sure that it's a commission decision to do this. It's your decision.
I
You're more worried about the ramifications of you publishing their names and numbers and coming back after TransCanada and saying, why did you put this on the internet? Is that what you're saying?
I, as a landowner, I think there probably are landowners who would be concerned about the broad dissemination of personal information. Just for the purpose of, you know, as you said, it was involuntary. But it's the commission's decision if you wish to release this information.
Well, thank you very much. And I would say that my comfort level with this is pretty low. I mean, I understand all the reasons why the commission shouldn't, ask TransCanada to provide this information redacted, again, so that it's just name and mailing location. Ms. Van Bakkeren.
As Mr. Bettman and I are talking back here, just a note for the commissioners that such a list is not normally something that we even ask for. It's not normally part of an application, and I'm wondering if that document was filed maybe with the Department of State or why we even received it. But it's not something we normally receive. It's not something we normally have in an application process.
We asked for it as part of a staff data request, which isn't put on the internet. Our data request responses are not part of the docket. We need to, it's for our use, for staff's use. We've never had one. In my recollection, it's never been part of a docket.
Yes, Mr. Smith.
Well, I just note we do have that new notice requirement, too. So I don't know that landowner, in terms of specific pipeline crossing landowners that we could identify, but that particular list is a list that we've been required to compile since July 1st.
I'll note, Mr. Smith, we've kept that list confidential.
I that's what I thought. Okay. I guess the other list you're talking about, I didn't even know that existed until today.
And I don't think it's part of a data request, actually. I think it's part of maybe something that, who knows, we don't require it in this state. It's not something we asked for.
Well, Commissioner Johnson here again. I do want to do a little more legal research on this. I mean, I would just, maybe suggest to my colleagues we take this under advisement. And I actually think the motion that was put on the agenda is probably not necessary. We don't normally formally accept applications in a commission meeting. And so I don't know that, the commission's been refiled with TransCanada. It appears as though, with the exception of maybe this one possible issue, they've complied with all of the commission's requests. I don't know that any action is required by the commission, but on this particular component, maybe we could take it under advisement and bring it up at a future meeting. Anybody have any concerns with that? If that's the case, then...
Nothing would change then, correct?
No.
And we're going to take, basically our only issue is the names of landowners.
Sure. And I just, I want to do a little more legal research for my own purposes before forcing any action that my comfort level isn't real high with.
I know.
Unless anybody has any objection to that, commissioners, I would say no action on this item. We take it under advisement. And we would certainly publicly thank TransCanada and staff for the quick turnaround time on all this information. Again, in Ms. Van Bakkeren's letter, she noted she thought it might take a week, and it took a couple of days. So thank you very much to everybody for getting that information out there. With that, we will stand adjourned.